So today we're going to have to interview David Lawrence Young. A little about him. David has 12 historical novels published and two on the way. Most of them are about English history, but two of them specifically are about... one is of Guns and Mules. It's the only novel about the Zion Mule Corps and the Jewish Legion in World War I. And of Guns, Revenge and Hope, about the Jewish Brigade fighting the Nazis and saving concentration camp survivors during World War II. Just briefly, David made Aliyah from the UK. He immigrated from the UK in 1968, and he's been teaching in schools and universities since then, and he presently lives in Jerusalem. So, welcome, David.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So, what made you come to live in Israel? And how? It's because you've been here a long time.
It's called an old-fashioned ideology. My mother had a good friend who came here in 1948, so we were always getting letters from Israel. And then I went to Habonim, Jewish Youth Movement, Jewish Scouts. Scouts before Habonim, and then after. And being in Habonim, it's a natural thing to try Aliyah. I came here the first time for 6 weeks after the Six-Day War. Felt quite at home immediately, had a good time, and said, right, I'm coming back. So I went back to England, taught for a year, and then came in 68, and I've been here ever since.
And where did you meet your wife?
I met my wife over a photocopy machine in the British Council, where she's from Australia, from Melbourne, and an English teacher. And we were both teaching part-time at the British Council, and I came along as a knight on a white horse and helped with the photocopy machine, and from then on, the rest is history.
And you have three children, correct?
Yeah. Got Vered, who is 38 and married and living in Modi'in. Nadav, who is 34, working in the theatre, living in Tel Aviv, and Yaakov, who is nearly 21 and is in the Air Force doing computers.
And when was the first time you realized that you were a writer?
That was quite early, actually, but I was writing more stuff for school and for internal books in school. And then the first book I wrote was about 13 years ago, about the Tolpanel Martyrs, who were a group of agricultural workers in England in 1830s, wanted to set up a union, and the landlords were against it. So they had them sent to Australia. And I thought it was a fascinating story, especially with the, let's say, socialist background of my family, and wrote it up as a book, and it got published. And then after that, started thinking of all different good stories to write, and so since then I've written about 13 books.
And history seems to be your interest, specifically. Why history? What did you find about historical novels or history that moved you?
I've always liked history, despite the fact I had the world's most boring history teacher ever in high school, who would just dictate notes. I'd never remember a single discussion on any topic. I remember we did... This was in England, we did American history, which I found fascinating, and still do, and Russian history as well, and as well as English history. The aspects I like about English history are the royalty over the years, and the way that the people, sort of through Parliament, have accumulated power over the years. So, these are the, and I also like military history, and... four of my books have been about Shakespeare or Shakespeare's time. So they're the main topics I deal with.
So who would you say was your greatest influence? Did you have anybody particularly?
In history, I can't think of any specific person. As a writer, I particularly liked Josephine Tay, who wrote The Daughter of Time, which was a detective novel about Richard III. Was he really a baddie? Did he really kill the little princes in the tower or not? And this is the big mystery in English history, even today, even though he was king for only 2 years. There's a Richard III Society in England still busy trying to defend his name, which was, of course, permanently blackened by Shakespeare. So I find this fascinating.
So most of your books have been about British history. Recently, the last two books have been specifically about history pertaining to Israel.
Yeah.
And you want to share how you made that switch, all of a sudden focusing for so long on UK history and then now focusing here?
Okay, I don't like to write about the same topic or the same era, like two books in a go. I like a difference. So like between writing a book about Anne of Cleves, who is Henry VIII's fourth wife, and Henry VIII's fifth wife, which I'm now working on, I wrote a book about a novel which hasn't been published yet, about capturing Adolf Eichmann, which is completely different. So it makes a complete break for me. It's like looking for a good topic in history that you think will make a good story. Like the book I wrote about arrows over Agincourt, like Henry V and how the few English hammered a French army about 5-6 times their size, or a book I wrote called Sail Away from Botany Bay about the first group of convicts who escaped from the first colony and some of them made it back to England. I mean, these are completely different topics and I find each one fascinating. The part that I really find fascinating of all is the writing and research. Finding publishers is hard work. especially in these days, even though there are more publishers and you can now do self-publishing or e-books, more people are writing. I mean, so every Tom, Dick and Harry with a computer thinks they're J.K. Rowling, so the competition is just as fierce as it was in the past, even though in theory there are more outlets, as it were, for getting your name into print.
How do you find the topic that moves you? Is it one day all of a sudden you have like an aha experience and wow, that's it and I'm going for it?
Yeah, it's an aha experience. Like about the Australian book I was reading, this hefty tome about the history of Australia, and there was a little paragraph about this group of guys who managed to escape from the camp and get back from the convict camp and get back to us and get back to London. And I thought, wow, that's a great topic for a story. And then I started looking around for material, and I was also in Australia a few weeks later with my wife, and I found stuff there, and that, and Google, and internet, and just being persistent looking around, I found the material enough for a book. So before, I was talking about Josephine Tay and her detective history novel, so this caused me to write a book. And the last Shakespeare book I wrote is called Will the Real William Shakespeare Please Step Forward? And it's about how a group of four university academics in England decide to go through the whole Shakespeare authorship problem or question. Because the question is, how can it be that this guy who came from a little town called Stratford, which was about 1,500 people, and with a small agricultural town 100 miles away from London, which is 3 days on horseback then, we're talking about 400 years ago, how could this guy have all the information, all the knowledge, all the inspiration to write such fantastic plays? And therefore a lot of people have come up with things like, well, it wasn't really Shakespeare who wrote it, it was Christopher Marlowe, or it was a lord who was well educated and well travelled, and he had the wherewithal to write this stuff. But since the theatre was not, was let's say frowned on, he wouldn't admit it. So he took the name of Shakespeare, who was an actor in London, and used his name as a pseudonym. So there are various lords. And then there are various series. In fact, it was a woman or several women or a group of people who wrote. So I went through this whole gamut of people who possibly wrote Shakespeare, and I wrote it in a detective form, but actually it's an academic book disguised as a detective novel, and that I found fascinating. and I'm not exaggerating here, I got so excited about it, I wrote the first draft, 95,000 words in just under 2 months. I was just scribbling away like crazy. I got all the various source material I could, and then just started writing. And I mean, the words flew off the page, off the pen. Then, of course, I had to have it edited. And after that, it's now been published in England at the end of last year.
Have you ever heard about this rumor, and someone had written, I forgot off the top of my head who it was, that Shakespeare might have actually been Jewish or had Jewish origin? Is this? Have you ever run across this?
No. Shakespeare was probably Catholic. They found a Catholic tract in the house in Stratford. But there's a rumor. There's the Dark Lady of the Sonnets. Now, who was this lady? Nobody knows. I've got a book at home that puts 14 ladies as candidates. One of them was Jewish, called Emilia Bassano, and she actually wrote some poems and is known about. And in my first novel I wrote about Shakespeare, called Will Shakespeare, Where Was He? He has an affair with her, leaving Anne Hathaway looking after the children in Stratford. But I think that's the nearest he got to Jews. I remember at the time there were officially no Jews in England. There were about 200 living in London. Queen Elizabeth I's doctor was Jewish, called Rodrigo Lopez. And the anti-Catholic and scared of Spanish influenced government of Elizabeth I used him as a spy, but then he did something dumb, like he told publicly that his employer, the Earl of Essex, had syphilis or something similar, and he ended up, Rodrigo Lopez ended up in the Tower and was later hanged, drawn and quartered. And this was soon before the time that that Shakespeare wrote Merchant of Venice. Jews are an academic thing, you know, they were the guys who killed Christ. We've never actually met any. And of course the big argument to that is, was Shakespeare anti-Semitic, yes or no? And rivers of ink have been written, and doctorates have been written on this. Those who say yes say, well, look at Shylock, I mean, he's the archetype of horrible Jew. And others say, yeah, but look at that lovely speech, hath the Jew eyes, etc., which shows how sensitive Shakespeare was to the Jewish question. So I tend to believe he wasn't anti-Semitic, but writing a play, I mean, Shakespeare had to make his money and had to make a living. So he's not going to write outright, Jews are lovely, nice people, we should get to know them. Anyway, there weren't that many. But he was a working playwright. So that was the scene, and he knew where his bread was buttered.
So moving from Shakespeare to Guns and Mules, share a little about how this evolved, how these two books evolved, Guns, Revenge and Hope, and Guns and Mules.
Okay, so Guns and Mules is, I believe, the only novel written about the Zion Mule Corps. There isn't that much written about them anyway, but I found it a fascinating story of how Jews in Tel Aviv then were exiled by the Turks, because they were seen as a potential fifth column, sent to Egypt, and then they linked up with the British who were in Egypt, who used them as the like the pioneer corps of the British Army then, and sent to Gallipoli. And I got even more involved in this because I went to Gallipoli a few years ago, crossed the Dardanelles, and did it with a stopwatch. It took 7 minutes in a rusty old ferry. But despite its lack of width, it's strategically important. The British and the French and the Australians really messed up their attack and were forced to retreat about 8 months later. The guy organizing the retreat was brilliant. It was an Australian general called Monash, who is a big hero in Australia. And then the guys went to fight on the Western Front. The Zion Mule Corps was disbanded after they came here and started helping the Jews against the Arabs, and the British didn't like that. So the British disbanded it and then restarted it, and they fought here in Palestine with the British rolling up the Ottoman Empire under the name of the Jewish Legion. So that was the... I like military history, I live in Israel, I like Israel, I've been in the army. So this book was a mixture of all of this. And then I thought, I've still got all this material, and what happened then? And then I got into the Jewish Brigade, which is in a way very parallel in the Second World War, where the British Army didn't want an actual Jewish unit. So they called up Jews in Palestine and Arabs in Palestine who would blockade Rommel, who seemed to be moving across North Africa very fast and was about to cut off the Suez Canal. And the Jews and the Arabs in the British Army would stop this. However, it worked out. 30,000 Jews enlisted voluntarily, only a few Arabs did. And they were put in the Palestine regiments and then fought in North Africa and then moved to Malta and then transferred to Italy and took part in the last part of the war, rolling up the Nazis from Italy. September 44, Churchill, against the advice of the British War Office, which was sort of pretty anti-Semitic, agreed there should be a Jewish brigade, a full British Army brigade, 5,500 men, and they took part in some of the last fighting in Italy, and also then used the resources of the British Army, transport, food, etc., to help concentration camp survivors and others who managed to get through to north of Italy, smuggle them on, or not only smuggle, send them to Palestine. The British didn't like this. And in 1946, summer 1946, disbanded the Jewish Brigade in the same way they disbanded the Jewish Legion, because it got too noisy. By the way, the British wanted to send the Jewish Legion, the Zion Mule Corps guys, to Ireland in 1916, and they said, forget it, we joined to fight the Turks, the Irish are your problem. Well, this is technically mutiny. Which was, if one guy disobeys orders in the army, that's one guy disobeying. If 600 odd together say no, this is mutiny. So the British are one of the reasons why they disbanded the Zion Mule Corps.
But, of course, Israel benefited from the experience of these soldiers. And that, was that, you think, one of the main reasons why they even wanted to become part of the war effort? In order to be able to have the experience, so they'd be able to come back and support the effort here against, obviously, the onslaught from the 48.
Ben-Gurion and others sort of saw the writing on the wall that we, pre-state Israel, needed the experience of military of guys working in large frameworks, and therefore many of the early generals and organizers of the Israeli army, etc., let's say cut their teeth in the Jewish Brigade in the British Army. So this was a very important part of it, apart from things like smuggling trucks and rifles and stuff back to be used later. But this, of course, is very much kept under the carpet, as it were.
May you live to be 120 or more. How would you like to be remembered as a author, writer, in terms of all the efforts that you put out to be able to share your knowledge and your experiences?
Looking ahead, I mean, today I'm 67. Let's say 50 years down the track, I make it 120. I think I'd like to be remembered as a author of historical novels who succeeded in making history interesting for other people, and someone who knew how to write a good story. I think that's what I'd like.
If someone reads a historical novel, so the essence of the story is based on facts, and then a story is written around it in order to be able to bring these facts out, but not everything in there, obviously, is factual. What responsibility do you have as a writer or as an author to be able to bring out the facts without manipulating in such a way that it obscures the truth?
As a historian, and maybe having been a teacher for 46 years, I think the truth in these books is very important. I work hard to make sure that the facts are facts. Also, if you're reading a history book or a novel and you come across a basic fact that is wrong, it removes all your credibility in the book and in the author. For example, say if you say the Battle of Hastings was in 1067 and not 1066, the guy reading it isn't thinking, this guy doesn't know what he's about. Therefore, I work hard to write. I'll give you a very simple example. In one of my books called Of Plots and Passions, which is about various conspiracies against the monarchy in England, William Rufus, William II, is killed in the New Forest. And I wanted to describe the New Forest, and I have a friend in England who lives near there. So I emailed him and I said, what trees grow in the New Forest? Because if I write, let's say he was standing behind a chestnut tree, and there are no chestnut trees, I mean, okay, not everybody knows this, but you only need a few people to know, and then the word gets out, and what you're writing is not very accurate. Therefore, if I use a fact, I make sure it is a fact, and you don't argue with it. The imaginative side, of course, comes with conversations and other things, but the basic facts, I work hard to make sure that they're very accurate.
Part of the criticism that I've been reading recently about movies, and one particular, The Butler, I guess it's very controversial in America, it just came out, but in essence is saying that while the person that they're trying to write about, this butler who was in the White House for a number of presidents, they took that fact and then stretched it beyond the reality to a point where they created scenarios that made things look a lot different than really existed, and put into words into the mouths of past presidents that their children were very upset about, that really just wasn't true. And like you said, it kind of then questions the whole credibility and the motive behind producing that movie. And I was just wondering if that can be a problem with historical novels, if someone writes something and obscures the facts to such a degree where it loses, like you were concerned about, the credibility of the entire idea or concept for that particular book.
No, for me this question, credibility and accuracy, is very, very important. I make sure that the book is sold as a novel. Like one book I had, the original cover didn't say novel on it or anything like that, and it had a very heavy style cover and it looked as if it was a textbook, so I contacted the publisher and said, no, you've got to change this, and you write the name of the book and you write a novel, so that there's no one feels they've been conned. But no, the credibility is super important for me.
Anyone particular that really is close to your heart and special for you?
I think the one, if I had to choose one, would be the book I've written about Eichmann that hasn't been published yet, possibly because it's of the most recent period when I was alive and remembered when Eichmann was caught and felt very pleased and followed the trial. So I wrote it from the angle that I was one of the team who caught him. Again, it's a novel, but very much based on the truth. And there was an exhibition about Eichmann in Tel Aviv last year, at Tel Aviv University. And I went to it and spoke to the curator who helped me with information and background information. And I'm not quite sure if it's because it's one of the most recent books, but it's certainly a very important book, and I would like it to be published and to sell well, not just because of the cash, but to put out the idea of what happened, who Eichmann was, and what we as a people have gone through to make a state.
When do you think that'll be available?
I'm hoping within the next year. I'm in contact with a couple of publishers and now waiting for some replies. On other things, I like touring around Israel. One of the side benefits of having taught in schools is every year we've gone out on school trips. Sometimes it hasn't been fun taking 40 kids with you, but on the other hand, I got to know certain places, and then I could go later with family and friends without being accompanied by 40 kids. So I went to all sorts of weird and wonderful places, especially in the Galilee and the Negev. This I enjoy a lot. Another thing I really like is the English language, using it for writing, and I find that my vocabulary when writing, my spoken vocabulary, are completely different. I'm bringing out words that I never use spoken, but use in the text, in the books. And I've been, for the last few years, how can I say without boasting, a ganzer Macher in the English Teachers Association. I was a treasurer and on the board of, on the governing board of this, and organizing conferences and giving talks like that, the history of English, various aspects of the English language, about slang, bad language. What is bad language? Is it just using not nice words, or is it using ungrammatical language, etc., etc.? So I find the whole question of English very important and exciting for me. And again, I think this comes out in my writing. I know that when I start editing, I look very carefully, also as an English teacher, what this sentence is horrible. It's not just a question of slang, it's just a horribly constructed. Or I'll write a sentence that's about 5 lines long, and knowing that anybody reading it will be gasping at the end, have to learn to chop it up and vary the vocabulary while writing. So this is all part of the writing process, and also being a teacher, and it's important to me.
Do you plan to continue to lecture about the English language in university level, or?
I've been asked to give talks at various organizations here, such as AACI, the American and Canadian organization. Also various groups in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Surprisingly, a couple of months ago, a group of adults in Tel Aviv, adult education, which consists of probably about 70% of little old ladies of about, I think they're about minimum age 70, asked me to give a talk about British military blunders over the years. I walked in there, saw the audience, thought they're going to be bored silly. Anyway, I gave the talk, and they started, at the end, started asking such interesting questions. I was completely flabbergasted. And another, a similar group somewhere else in Ramat HaSharon, they asked me to give a talk about sexual scandals in the British royal family. I mean, I had a good time preparing this and doing the research. And I thought, they're not going to buy this. They bought it, they lapped it up and said, please come back with some more.
That's always a success.
So yes, now that I've fully retired, I plan to do more lecturing, probably mainly on British history, military history and Shakespeare. I gave a series of talks called Important Years in History, and chose various years in history, like 1066, Battle of Hastings, 1215, Magna Carta, 1776, of course, America, 1945, the New World, 1956, about Suez. So, and now I'm preparing a series of talks about literature, completely different, talks about poets like E.E. Cummings, and writers, not only about Shakespeare, and I hope to do that with AACI in Jerusalem. Working with the Jewish History Society, and they've asked me to give a talk about Rodrigo Lopez, who was Queen Elizabeth I's Jewish doctor, and as I said, he was hung, drawn and quartered later. And tie the whole Jewish thing up, and I think I'm going to call it Queen Elizabeth and the Jewish Problem. being a writer now and in the 21st century has forced me to use computers more. I'm not much of a computer geek.
By the way, do you use the computer when you write, or do you still write by hand?
I write by hand because I can't think and use a computer at the same time. So I write by hand and then I copy it onto the computer, which of course is my first editing. And you hear muttering like, wow, what a sentence, you get rid of that one quick. And so I use a computer for writing, for editing, for emails and looking up things on Google, etc. I've also got a website, which is www.dly-books.com. And that I update, and on this site I'm running at the beginning on the home page I've got a Shakespeare quiz which I change every 2 or 3 weeks, and people can answer it and send the answers to my email, which is dlwhy08@gmail.com.
Do you have any advice for any young up-and-coming author, writer, any ideas or any suggestions for them in order to inspire them to keep writing and hopefully their dreams can be fulfilled someday?
First of all, choose a topic that really interests you, because otherwise writing on something that afterwards you get fed up with is like pulling teeth, or you'll just not continue. You also need a fantastic amount of patience to find a publisher, especially if you want to be in print. If you're writing in your home country, of course you can self-publish, which I haven't done at all here, because my books are normally about England, and to self-publish from here and then try and sell in England, I think would be a big problem. But you need a heck of a lot of patience. The books of advice to authors say get an agent. Getting an agent is as hard as getting a publisher. You really need deep pockets. Do not throw away your daytime job, as they say, and just keep at it. You've got to persevere. I know this sounds like a cliche. I've been through it. I still get nervous every time I'm trying to find a publisher or change a publisher. And so for me, the fun is writing and research. The hard work is the publishing side of it all.
What do you think about books now, you know, where you can buy your books and put it right on a Kindle or any other kind of electronic apparatus? How do you feel about that?
I think it's a good idea. I personally don't use Kindle or anything like this. I know friends who do. My wife for the first time this summer borrowed one and enjoyed using it very much. I still like holding a book and reading a book that way. But I think as a way of getting your name out there, especially as a new writer, it's probably a good way. Commercially it's probably okay as well, because these books are much cheaper. I read an article recently, some English guy author found he wasn't selling his books, put his book made it into an e-book at a ridiculously cheap price, I mean less than a dollar, and he started selling hundreds. I've been in contact with my last publisher and I said, let's try an experiment. You're bringing it out as a print book, okay, with a standard price, whatever it was in the States. Let's try the e-book really cheap. And the last thing she told me recently was, it's beginning to sell well. So maybe there's something in it.
But all of your books can be bought on Amazon among Geffen and other publishers, is that correct, their websites?
Yeah, all these books can be bought on Amazon and any other site like Barnes & Noble. Some of them are under David L. Young, but most of them are under D. Lawrence Young. Hope those people who read my books enjoy them, And I'll be very happy if you send any remarks, positive, negative, mixture of, to dlwhy08@gmail.com. Right? Thank you very much. And also have a look at my website.
Thank you so much, David.